Off the Ball, GAA.
Oh my God, outrageous. But like, we were quietly confident coming into the game, like, you know, so I'm not too surprised that we won.
Join in the obsession. Subscribe now at offtheball.com/join.
Have you seen anything like that?
I'm a very confident front runner for Kelly for 33 years, 145 wins now, and that's the best win I've ever had.
I have no idea what you have.
I don't know. How are we going to count all the shots? I can't keep track.
Fuck! God damn it!
I don't think he's pleased.
Of course I would. That's a particularly stupid question. It's the Irish Open. Of course I want to play at the weekend.
Good afternoon, welcome to Golf Weekly. In the hot seat this week for Fionn. He's away or couldn't be bothered or somewhere nice. But delighted to say Dave McIntyre is with me. How are you, Dave?
Very well. A bit rich from you telling our listeners that he's away and somewhere nice, given that you're speaking to us from Barbados.
I'm working, actually, technically.
How are the preparations going along for the Legends Tournament event in the Caribbean? It is the Caribbean, good. Isn't it?
It is, yeah. I got in Sunday night, so played a practice round yesterday. Of course, we're playing at Apes Hill this week, so where they play the last two editions of this event. I played 2 years ago, missed out last year through injury, but yeah, the course is fantastic. Really good. You know, we played a Monday practice for a Friday start, and you could have played the start of the tournament yesterday, so it's in really good nick.
And just sort of for our listeners, for them to know, I went through the field there while we were waiting just to start recording. It's absolutely chock-a-block with big names from the past. Stacked with former Ryder Cuppers. I think there's five former major champions. And of course, your good self. It's a good field.
Yeah. Ryder Cup players and podcasters.
Yeah. Who's who of golf? Golf legends.
No, it is. And the standard is great. There was a big influx about 10 guys last year, former Ryder Cup players. Jamie Donaldson was probably the marquee who came out and won, I think, about a second or third start. Scott Hens, who's not mentioned in that, is the kind of best player on the tour, really. He almost won the senior PGA last week, finished third. So, yeah, it should be a great week. And hopefully, if I can play myself, I might have this week.
Good stuff. Well, listen, the very best to look at it.
I'm going to try grow some or gain some inspiration from Matt Fitzpatrick. So he won again Sunday night for a second win of the season at two kind of classic venues. I've never played Harbortown, but I've watched that tournament for so many years, and it's just a classic old style course in the Pines. And he won at Innsbruck as well, which is a really difficult course. So he's up to a high in the world rankings of third, Dave, which is a serious step up from, considering it's not longer than maybe 2 years ago he was in and out of coaches and struggling for form. And he now, I think he's translated onto the PGA Tour what he was doing in Europe. You know, he's always been a really good closer, and to take out Scheffler was powerful stuff.
Look, I love this tournament. I think it's a really appropriate place for the tour to move on to as its next stop after Augusta, because there's not such a massive drop off in terms of the quality of the event. It's a signature event. It's an iconic golf course. It's a course that people love to play, and it's a real shot makers golf course as well. So it's not like you're heading from the Augusta National to the bloody Valspar or the Wyndham Championship or something. It's actually worth tuning in to watch, because there's some iconic holes. That last hole, I absolutely love that, with the lighthouse in the background, and there's always a great feel to the place. And for Fitzpatrick to win there is really appropriate, because he's been a fan of that place since he was a teenager. I think he used to go on holidays there with his parents when he was a kid, and he absolutely loves playing around there. And he once said, I'd rather win this before the Masters. Now obviously it was tongue in cheek, but the fact that even that sort of a thought would enter his head shows the affinity that he has for the place. Obviously they present the winner with a jacket. It's not quite green, but it's of a slightly less attractive hue. But I think if he wins nothing else, and if our listeners haven't watched this, just go and watch the last hole and the playoff. There's about an 8-minute video on YouTube of the 18th, the 72nd hole, and the playoff hole. Obviously, he'll always be remembered for his bunker shot to win the US Open. It's one of the great closing hole shots in US Open history. It was an 8-iron, wasn't it, that he hit that day?
Yeah.
With Billy Foster on the bag. But the two shots he hits on 18, on the regulation 18th, the 72nd hole, and then the playoff, two four irons. Oh, they're so good with massive pressure on him into a stiff breeze. And I love watching him play because he's a guy who has turned himself into an elite level golfer when you didn't necessarily look at him a decade ago and think that he had the tools to do so. He seems to take the partisanship of the crowd very casually and well, and is able to feed off it. He's able to look adversity in the eye and take it on. He's just taken down the world number one, who absolutely bottled his second shot into the playoff hole at 18 when Fitzpatrick
Oh,
what happened, Scheffler, there?
I think I don't know whether he was in between clubs, and he obviously mishit it, but it just ballooned up with nothing on it, which was most unlike him. But because that hole normally plays, you know, the fairways is the width of Ireland, and
even
you know,
I could hit that fairway.
Yeah, that might get you back playing golf. Just hit a few drives there, but you know, it wasn't a target for a four iron into a serious draft off the left. So Fitzpatrick, it was stellar coming in. It really was.
But as the pro out of this two ball, Gary, can you explain to us how hard that bunker shot was for his second into the 72nd hole, that far back into a breeze and the ball below his feet with the ball in the sand and his feet outside of the bunker?
It's just your nightmare scenario because, you know, Sandy Lyle, which was probably the most famous bunker shot prior to that, in 88 at Augusta, there's no margin for error. So, you know, if you slightly hit behind it off the fairway, especially with modern day clubs, you'll get a little bit of bounce out of the ground. When you do that out of sand, it's just, you know, that whatever it was, 150, 160-yard shot's only going to go maybe 110, 120. So there's no margin for, he's trying to win his first major. He's shaking like a leaf. And it just proves, you know, he won the US Amateur totally against the head, really. And then he came on tour, played Ryder Cup very quickly, was leading amateur in the Open. You know, so he had the CV to suggest he was going to be a top player. But when you saw him, it didn't look like he had the game. He was just a remarkable putter. He didn't have very much power. He was just really steady. And in today's game, that's probably not going to get you very far. So he came out on tour with what he had, very similar to Borric Harrington, to be brutally honest. And 4 or 5 years into it, it's very same as it. It's quite similar, actually, just thinking of it with Harrington. Like, Borric got out on tour in 96 and didn't really make the dramatic changes for kind of 4 or 5 years, and went to Bob Torrance and turned himself into an elite ball striker aligned with the putting and short game. And that's kind of what it looks like Fitzpatrick has done now. He was with Pete Cowan and Mike Walker for a long time, and decided to go to Blackburn, who seems to be, you know, the new prize pony coaching-wise, and the results are astonishing, along with the, you know, increase in distance, which is huge. I don't think you can compete nowadays if you're not, you know, at least a kind of 175 ball speed. So, and he's taken every stat, Dave, every shot he's hit since he's 15. So he's a very good focus and desire to want to get the most from himself.
Yeah, if anybody saw his episode of Full Swing, I think it was season one of Full Swing on Netflix, his episode was amazing. Gave you such an insight into the level of detail that he goes to off the golf course. He takes note of every single competitive shot he's ever hit and all of the detail that goes with it. So he's got that banked for him to be able to go back into his own personal archive and see where he's lacking, where he's developing, what needs to be tweaked. And yeah, look, the power that he has gained and his ball speed, it just goes to show that anybody chasing length and ball speed can do it if they're given the right tools and they've got the dedication to do it, as opposed to just bulking up, say, like Bryson did in an attempt for him to do that. He's still a whippet, Matt Fitzpatrick. He does not have an athletic build at all. He doesn't look like a professional athlete at all. And yet his ability to get the absolute most out of a swing is incredible. And he's, you know, he's a major champion. He's now won 4 times on the PGA Tour. Obviously, he's been a serial winner in Europe as well. There was a little moment when they were preparing to take their tee shots in the playoff, and he just went up to Scotty and shook his hand and said, "Hi, I'm Matt Fitzpatrick." And it was just a little insight into how self-deprecating he can still be, as in, you're a four-time major champion, you're the world number one, I'm still a nobody here. Even clearly, though, Matt Fitzpatrick does not believe that in his own mind. He clearly believes that he belongs in that elite company. But to come up with a little quip like that, well, he must have been nervous. I know he's won there before, also beat a former major champion, former Masters champion, and a serial major championship winner in Jordan Spieth in a playoff. But I really have come to have a real fondness for Matt Fitzpatrick, not just for...
Dave, I interviewed him at the Czech Masters in maybe... Yeah, it would have been 2016, where he finished, I think, second or third, or wherever he finished. But it was to get his spot on the Ryder Cup team. And he did the kind of live interview afterwards, and then he came in and did the studio stuff. And like, he's such a lovely guy. Really dry Yorkshire sense of humour, so there's a good bit of crack out of him as well. And he's probably, I think the full swing will help, because he looks like the class nerd, really, doesn't he? But and PB, he hasn't got a lot of credit for his personality. And I think he's grown massively, probably through Italy, because at Whistling Straits, he was a bit of a whipping boy, really. So I do think he's learnt a lot on the job, which is a sign of a top professional. But as you said, like, to close out Scheffler and Spieth, two kind of heroes around there. So it's a nice, unless we were, I know you're a huge fan of Liv, but that's kind of part of the thing with the PGA Tour, with the tradition of these events, you know, that you grew up as a kid seeing that event and going, I'd love to win that. And now it's a signature event. So a bag load of FedEx points, and the only way is up, seemingly, for Fitzpatrick. He'll be, you know, jumping for the next major.
Yeah, look, you brought up Liv, not me. Okay, so let the record show that the first mention of Liv this week was delivered by yourself. It's something that no matter how successful Liv becomes, and right now the vibes would suggest its days of success are likely to be very limited. But look, we'll see how that transpires. I'm sure we'll get into that in a few minutes. But if you look at the winners list, the honours list at Harbortown, like, you've got like Payne Stewart, Norman, Davis Love, Zeller won twice, Langer, Faldo, Watson, like Jack Nicklaus, Johnny Miller, Hale Irwin, Arnold Palmer. Bloody hell, like, there's such a history there that any tournament on Liv will never, ever be able to rival. And it's so warming when you watch a tournament, and this is what makes the Masters, one of the countless reasons of why the Masters is the best tournament in the world, because you tune in and you know what the holes look like, and you know who played what shots on this hole in previous years, and where this tournament was won and lost and thrown away and snatched. It's almost similar, not to the same extent, obviously, but to a similar extent at Harbortown. You know what the holes look like, and you know what sort of a shot is required. And to see two major champions go at it down the stretch in a signature event with a $3.5 million paycheck for the winner in testing conditions and knowing that big breeze was coming into them in 18, I loved it. Absolutely loved it. And it's been a while since I've been able to say that about the PGA Tour, but... Yeah. I know that it isn't like that every week, and you will still have a 25 under par, no name winner probably coming down the track soon enough. But the last 3 or 4 weeks have been absolutely brilliant.
I do find, though, that you know, you've got the Arnold Palmer, you've got the players, you've got Innsbruck, that Florida swing, and then coming and, you know, the two events in Texas don't really seem to capture any imagination. I know it's a build up to Augusta, but it's kind of right back at it then with Harbortown. But it kind of leads me on to Zurich this week. I suppose finishing off a little bit on Harbortown, it was another kind of sluggish week for Lowry, really. He was down the field and disappointing in a sense, because that really is his kind of golf course. He's had two good chances to win around there. And with his accuracy from the tee and his elite level iron play, it's another, you know, tippy-tappy week. And he just... didn't really bounce from Augusta, and still seems to be in a little bit of a low.
Yeah, look at the list of winners of the last 7 or 8 years. Gary, Fitzpatrick, Justin Thomas, Scheffler maybe a little bit of an outlier, but Fitzpatrick against Spieth, Sink and Webb Simpson. Like, Lowry is as good, if not better, than all of those guys. And It is an iron player's golf course, isn't it? I just think it's similar to where he was at the Arnold Palmer after his meltdown at the Cognizant. He really struggles to rouse himself the week after a desperately disappointing finish. And he has spoken himself about how devastated he was by how Sunday transpired for him at Augusta. So upset was he that he couldn't even bring himself to celebrate with Rory. And I think everybody totally understood where he was coming from on that. So here we are in a similar circumstances a week on. He has to kind of pack the bags, probably didn't even get to go home. I'm not sure if he would have bothered going home. He has to go from Augusta to Harbortown for what is a signature event. And it is a real shame. Like if he'd shot, you know, a 69 or a 70 on Sunday and maybe lost to Rory by three or four shots, but like had acquitted himself well, he may well have rolled into Harbortown. And what an opportunity it would be for him. But as it happened, he left Augusta devastated and was not able to rouse himself for another week on the tour.
How do you think his pairing? So he's an ambassador for RBC now and Zurich. So he's got some nice sponsorship deals going there. Brian Moran's done a good job for him. But he's playing with Koepka this week. Obviously, 1 year, 2 years ago with Rory in the tied 12 last year defending. But Rory is now playing the schedule he's probably always wanted to play. So he's going to pick and choose and prepare around the majors. How important is this week for Lowry and Koepka?
Yeah, it's interesting. I think Lowry and McIlroy were really good for each other in that week, weren't they? I think Rory was coming back off a disappointment, and it was just tournament fell at the right time for him. He was able to play for fun, and we saw them out celebrating, not celebrating, the tournament wasn't even over, but out together in New Orleans that on the Saturday night, I think it was. And then obviously we saw the celebrations after. Rory was singing Don't Stop Believing on stage, and it was Shane's first win of any description on the PGA Tour for 3 years. Obviously, he preferred an individual win, but it got him some rights and got him a healthy paycheck. So I'm not surprised that this is not a tournament that McIlroy was planning on turning up to on an annual basis. I don't know about the pairing. You may know more about this sort of relationship that Koepka and Lowry have than I do. What have you heard? Where did this team come from?
Well, they both live in West Palm Beach. They're pally, I think. They practice a bit together. Obviously, with Ricky is Koepka's caddy with that Irish connection. And I think they are pretty pally off the course. I think it's an interesting week for Koepka because obviously, you know, he's not really playing an A-lister schedule at the moment. And whilst it's a huge tournament and all the notoriety of as a PGA Tour winner comes with it, that really ignited Lowry a couple of years ago to continue his fine form on the PGA Tour. I think there's kind of something in it for both of them, really. And the fact that they are pally off the course does make it a little bit easier. But it's kind of an event that was in, you know, I think the pairings has kind of helped. I think this is about the ninth year they have it now, and it's just something different. You know, four balls is good fun. They'll all go crazy, be shooting low 60s. And then you have foursomes, which is probably the hardest form of golf. And they should be a good pairing on paper. Like, if you were thinking if they were both on a Ryder Cup team together, you'd think, yeah, well, there's no, both drive it great, both the lead irons. The only thing might be the putting. You know, I think Shane looked to me, now we didn't see a lot of him on the final day at Augusta, but it looks like his putting has gone awry a little bit. So maybe playing in a pairing might help him a little bit with that. But I think they can both get something out of the week. But it's fascinating, Dave, looking at where the DP World Tour has gone. There's a lot of young Europeans playing this week. There's a lot of kind of cool pairings. There's probably about seven or eight. Obviously, the headline is going to be the Fitzpatricks. You know, Alex won, I would imagine his last start was India. I don't think he's played since. His brother has won last week. I think they're listed as favourites with some outlets. So it's a huge week for Alex Fitzpatrick, but I don't know where I stand. I know the European Tour, they're getting probably, what, 50 million a year from the PGA Tour. The top 10 players go every season. But there's kind of two ways to look at it. It does feel an amazing opportunity for these young players, but also depleting. You know, the Volvo China Open is on this week, and it's hardly even spoken of. So seven or eight decent players are not in China because they're going to be here this week.
It's, I think the winner of this gets a two-year exemption of the PGA Tour. So for someone like Alexis Patrick, I know it's a blow for the European Tour to be losing some guys of their younger high-profile guys this week. But it, for those little mini stories, a lot of backstories this week, isn't there? It might be worth tuning in. I'm not sure I'll be glued Thursday and Friday and Saturday, but if Lowry and Brooks Koepka are in and around the mix and the Fitzpatricks are at the weekend, it's worth a look.
Yeah, it's just such a different space, I think, now for younger players coming through. Like when I played on tour, if you did really well, your only access was to maybe get in the top 100, which got you USPGA, which you could do something, or else, you know, go to tour school, which is a tricky thing to do, because in those days you couldn't play, you could go to tour school and get a card, but you couldn't really play both tours. A, because the standard was, you know, difficult, and a lot of players tried it and it didn't work out. And then you'd no safety net if you came back to Europe. So you kind of could lose a status on both tours, where now they have a kind of a parachute back in. So I think we're just going to see, you know, you see Marco Penge, he's settled in quite nicely in the States, considering he's changed location, he's changed equipment, they had another baby. He seems to have settled in. Jordan Smith is another who has settled in. I don't know if the live thing doesn't shake down, you know, if it's gone at the end of the year, there's going to be a lot of guys looking for somewhere to play. So maybe the DP World Tour might, you know, because that all, what, where you, I don't know, I just found, and I know you're not a fan of live, but I have watched it a bit, and I think Ram's win didn't just, it just didn't seem like much last weekend. You know, he failed miserably by his standards at Augusta, and he goes down to Mexico and wins by six shots. You know, the tour could be done at the end of the year. It's hard to, you know, I know you're not a fan of the guys that went, but it's a tough space for these guys not knowing what's going to happen.
Well, yeah, look, a tough space maybe for some of the lower ranking LIV players whose, you know, joining fee wasn't what it was for the likes of Mickelson and Rahm and DeChambeau. So if you're looking at someone like a Matthew Wolff or Harald Varner III, or and when he probably got well paid, but there are a lot of lads on that who I would really struggle to get back into a DP Tour World event or a PGA Tour event. So maybe I have a little, you know, ounce of sympathy for those guys, but certainly have no sympathy for the likes of Rahm. And
no, you know,
I'm a bit blinkered, obviously, when it comes to Liv, and I'm even more blinkered when it comes to Liv and John Rahm, as I've been hammering him for weeks now on this podcast, and people are probably sick of it, but he was awful at Augusta, and here he rocks up a week later. We saw how devastated Larry was by what happened to him on Sunday, and he really struggled to get his game going at the weekend, but Rahm's able to rock up and win by six the following week and shoot 7 under in the following and the final round, win by on 21 under par. And look at the guys he's beaten, Gary. Puig, is that how you pronounce the second name?
Puig. he's gonna be a top player though, Dave.
Oh yeah, who cares, Gary? Ballester, S. Vincent, I've never heard of. Tom McKibben, obviously, and Matthew Wolff, our names, Thomas Dietrich, Brandon Grace, Tyrrell Hatton. Like, there's maybe a couple of names there that I'd actually get out of bed to watch, but
yeah,
it's just so hard to care.
I do think, because I was never at the top end, I do think the fallout for this is good. So what happened during COVID, the Asian Tour basically shut down and guys had literally no income and nowhere to play. And then the Saudis came in and bought LIV, but obviously they needed an avenue. So they pumped a lot of money into the Asian Tour, which has always been a great tour. And a great place, you know, it's kind of breeding ground tour. But for the locals, a great way to play and earn a living. Very well supported tour. My worry is if they pull the plug on LIV, they'll put the plug on the Asian tour. And
there will be repercussions, obviously.
There will, and it'll affect, you know, even some Irish guys have gone over there over the years, and it's a great way to. And there's proper money on that tour. You know, it's hard on the hotel planner playing for 250 grand a week to actually earn a living. And a lot of guys try pro golf, do 4 or 5 years, doesn't happen, and they're skint. Whereas the Asian Tour, you can actually earn some decent money. So I would imagine they'll just wipe the slate and pull the plug on everything if they do, which would be a shame for golf in that area. But it might in turn help the DP World get back into markets that it's lost because of LIV?
We have a new addition, Gary.
Oh,
we are now three ball.
Mr. Hogan has arrived.
Yeah, sorry, boys. I'm slightly embarrassed. I'm well, but I was watching the coverage of the Keir Starmer saga and things on the television, and yes, I fell asleep. Sorry about that. So.
Retired life, John. Well, it's funny, John, that you're looking at a political show.
Oh, tell me about it. I'm showing my age.
It's unusual looking at a political show and then you come out and tell the truth. So, fair play to you.
Well, there is that, yes. What else could I say? Yeah. Sorry. Anyway, my apologies.
How is life treating you, John? Are you enjoying... did you enjoy Augusta last week? Did you enjoy Harbour Town?
I did, very much, both in fact, yes. It's interesting watching Augusta from a distance. I see far more of what's going on than I ever did when I was there, because, as you know, when you go and do the job I was doing, you've normally got an assignment, so you're focused on one thing, and so many things pass you by. So I definitely get a more rounded view of what's actually happening than I did when I was actually there, believe it or not.
What was the feedback in Scotland like on Robert McIntyre? Because I know Garcia got a lot of heat, but McIntyre seemed to be misbehaving a bit too.
Well, yeah, I think it's disappointing. I have to be honest, he's not my favourite. I think he's a terrific golfer, but I do think he's been let down in some ways by... The coverage he receives in Scotland is quite, you know, sycophantic, has been to this point. And maybe he's getting used to that. And he's able to, feels he can behave in ways that are, you know, inappropriate. I mean, if you're going to pick a time and a place to behave in the way that he did and the way that Sergio was almost even worse, you wouldn't pick Augusta National. I mean, the tolerance there for anything that steps outside the correct, in between the right lines, if you like, it's not high. So it was a strange thing, and I hope he learns from it. The one disappointing thing since is that, I mean, Sergio, for all his faults, at least apologised, albeit 2 or 3 days later, but there's been no apology from McIntyre, which kind of, to me, betrays a bit of an arrogance that I don't like to see, but... I'm not a huge fan of some of the things that go on at Augusta. Some of the rules seem a bit daft, but I think golf has got a standard. You've played tournament golf long enough. I mean, he won't be the most popular companion on the course, I'm sure, behaving like that. I mean, anything that affects the other guy that you're playing with is not to be approved of. I mean, obviously, that's rule number one. I would have thought that anything that you do that affects the other guy and his ability to play his best is like the, you know, top of the list of things. I cannot do that. But yeah. I'd be interested to hear on your view of it.
Well, I had a row, quite a magnificent row years ago in the Austrian Open with a guy who I actually really liked, Thomas Aiken, South African guy. And I had about maybe a 3-foot putt for par, which I'd marked my ball, and he went to hold a birdie putt and he missed it, and he went to knock it in and he missed it and he hit it in the hole then. And he picked up the ball and he volleyed it off the green. But when the ball was in the air, it was literally over the hole.
Right.
And I was remarking my ball at the same time. So if he had shanked it or mishit it, which was easily to do,
yeah,
he could have taken me out or taken someone else out. And I just started screaming at him with some magnificent profanities.
Yeah.
And basically, what the frank are you doing? And la, la, la. And then, because I was in such a temper, I got up and I actually yipped my putt, like a full yip.
Yeah.
And then I got up on the next screen and I three-putted it. And I literally wanted to smash his head in. Which I would normally not do, because I'd just fix it there. And then I reported him afterwards. Yeah. And Thomas was he was a really nice guy. He just had a moment, but his behavior was disgraceful. And I think he got fined or whatever. But I ended up finishing fifth in the tournament, and it really, if I, I think I was finishing a front nine, which was my lap back nine, and I maybe dropped a couple of shots and didn't birdie the last type of thing, and ended up finishing fifth, but could have been a lot better. So I do think a lot of the times people lose sight of the fact if a guy's been an absolute asshole on the course, it does does affect other guys.
I was reminded a little bit of the way that Joe LaCava behaved on the last screen in Italy at the Ryder Cup when he got involved with the Rory's preparation for the putt. In the wake of that, I mean, I thought, my goodness, that's the last thing that any caddy should be doing. And as I say, in the wake of it, I spoke to a number of top caddies, you know, maybe half a dozen, and every single one of them cited that as the rule that cannot be broken by a caddy.
To put
the other guy off. I mean, if I'd been Cantley, Joe LaCava's caddy, I would have fired him on the spot.
Yeah.
You cannot be doing that. And I'd have been tempted to concede Rory's putt as well, you know. If
I do think the Ryder Cup of times can do funny things to guys, and they lose the run of themselves. And the thing with the crowd, you know, I think Fitzpatrick referenced it last week that you know, he used the crowd to, you know, he enjoyed the atmosphere. He's you know, a mad Sheffield United fan. He's been the underdog his whole life, and I'm sure, you know, he reveled in that atmosphere.
He did say, Gary, none of it went across the line.
No, it didn't.
And,
no, it didn't.
You know,
no,
I think these golfers accept that an atmospheric golf course and a partisan crowd and one golfer being favoured over the other is just part of the game, as long as it doesn't cross the line and it doesn't descend into personal abuse. And Fitzpatrick was very quick to point out that was not the case at Harbortown. Yeah, it was loud. Yes, they were very clearly favouring Scottie Scheffler, but he's the American in what is essentially a two-ball match play final with a tournament on the line. And Fitzpatrick is experienced enough and well-rounded enough to accept that that's the way it goes. And if the shoe is on the other foot and it was, you know, at Wentworth or a French Open or a big tournament in the UK or a year, it would be a similar situation, but the other way around.
John, what's your, quickly, we've just touched on it with, I was referencing, you know, the fact that Liv might be in full demise at the end of the year and perhaps ramifications for the Asian Tour. Do you think it might work out as a benefit for the DP World Tour going forward?
It could. It could, absolutely. Yeah. It depends on how they react. I mean, there's obviously decisions to be made on what do you do with guys, returning guys, if you like. I think the superstar element, DeChambeau and Rahm, although Rahm's dug himself a pretty deep hole, but DeChambeau, I think, will be all right. He'll find a way back to the PGA Tour fairly quickly. But, and you're right about the Asian Tour. The Asian Tour might be the only place that guys have the ability to play for the next year to 18 months, say. But the European Tour, they're in a nice position. I think they've got a lot of leverage. I think they can say to the Neimans, the guys want one step down from the real superstars on Liv, not that there are many left, but Neiman's the one that always comes to mind. He's a really good player, and he's done a fair bit of supporting of the European Tour the last couple of years. He's played in a few when he's been able to. I remember seeing him at the end of season thing in Dubai a couple of years ago and did a wee story on him, and I think he'd be keen to come back and play, given the fact that the PGA Tour is a closed shop. So that you can look at the European Tour can look at this as an opportunity, or they can play hardball, you know, and say, well, you've got to, there'll be certain things that these guys are going to have to do. They're not going to just get to walk back straight back in. That would be unfair, I think, on certainly you're dealing with the membership. I mean, the Turkey's voting for Christmas phrase comes to mind a little bit. But I think it would be incumbent on the European Tour to find a way to get a lot of these guys back. I mean, even the older guys, I mean, they bring a, you know, I mean, I like going to the Senior Open every year, for example, because I like to watch the guys in my age group, or if almost my age group. But like yourself, Gary, I mean, I would welcome the chance to see you play for a week. But they depends how they look at it. I mean, I don't know what the thinking would be on the European Tour. I think there would be certain restrictions put on them, or certain things. Well, you have to do A, B, and C, but if you do that, come back in. And I think European Tour would be silly to make it too difficult. I don't think they're in a strong enough position to make it almost impossible for these guys to come back, because they would certainly add to the tour, especially. I don't know if you've touched on the top 10 thing.
Yes.
Guys to the PGA Tour. I mean, that's starting to have a little bit of an effect.
The Patrick Reed situation, John, is a prime example of it, isn't it?
Yeah,
he's being rehabilitated on the European Tour, and he's the blueprint for how this should play out.
Yeah, and he's adding to the European Tour for sure. I mean, it's more attractive when he's added a little thing a couple of months ago when he was winning. But he was beating fields where there was one where he was the only one, or there was one other guy in the top 100 in the world in the field. Yeah. The European Tour needs to get away from that. That's not going to attract sponsors too much.
Because Henrik Stenson is making his debut on the Legends Tour this week here in Barbados. And so his last live event was last August, so he can't play on the Champions Tour until August.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it'll be great for our tour to have him here and add a bit of glitter to the show. But I worry, I think the Saudis are going to pull the plug. If they do, I think the Asian tour will get badly hampered from it. And that's been a great pathway for, you know, lots of, you know, back in the day, lots of American guys who couldn't go through. You know, Tom Lehman found his feet out in the Asian tour before he became the player he was. Mm. So, it's a fascinating space, but I do think John Rahm has a little bit of egg in his face, because if it does cease to exist at the end of the season, he, you know, his entitlement of, I don't want to play four events, or I don't want to play six events, I'll only play four. Well, that doesn't hold any water. So hopefully he might come back into the fold for a Ryder Cup discussion.
They will find a way to get him back onto the PGA Tour, though, won't they? Like, there's absolutely no way. And even Rolak said during the week, Brian Rolup, it's my job to make the PGA Tour the best tour in the world. And if you read between the lines from what he was saying, we will do whatever it takes. Yes, we said the door had closed on that offer that they had on the table for these live golfers, and obviously Koepka was one who took advantage of it. But they're going to open up something, aren't they, to entice DeChambeau and Rahm back. They're not going to have them playing somewhere else for a year when they could be playing their signature events in the US.
Well, you say that, but if you're the PGA Tour, I mean, they've been gone, what is it, 4 or 5 years now? The live thing's been going, and things move on. I mean, there's another generation of players. I mean, there's an endless conveyor belt of players coming onto the PGA Tour from America, really good. And the PGA Tour just might, I mean, I'm not saying this would be the right thing to do, but knowing them the way I do, they just might say, you know what? We don't even need you. DeChambeau might be different because he's American and high profile. But Rahm, you know, I think Rahm's dug himself a really deep hole, and the Asian Tour might be his only option, you know, for at least in the short term. But I'm not so sure that the PGA Tour won't play, as I say, hardball with those guys, and there'll be a few hoops for them to jump through.
Well, there was a fascinating article in the New York Post about DeChambeau, because his contract's up at the end of the season, looking for half $1 billion to re-sign. So he obviously is not reading the room.
Yeah.
But did you see his body language at the weekend before he withdrew in Mexico, Gary? Like, there was a couple of clips during the rounds, one where he's missed a putt because he's pulled it, essentially, and he looks absolutely mystified, and he's staring at his caddy as if, how could that putt possibly not have dropped it? It was a real insight. It was a throwback to the Bryson of old, before he totally regenerated his image as a YouTube golfer and as a man of the people, and the backslapping of the high fives of the crowd and everything. And then he's bitching and moaning about some a patch of scrubland, essentially, where he found himself in a pretty crappy lie because he was a bit astray off the beaten path, and he's given out and he's looking for a rules official to come over. And it was just a little window into the Bryson of old that we haven't seen for a year or two. And I've never seen him behave like that on live. And it just happened to coincide with the week that all the rumours surfaced about the financial plug being pulled and the broadcast feed went down. And there were some comments brushed from TNT that were made by their CEO about only being funded for till the end of the season. And then they were airbrushed out of the interview, re-edited, and then the interview was posted back up again on TNT subsequent to that. And those specific comments had been removed. Is it a coincidence, John, that Bryson was behaving like this just in this one week, with everything else that was going on in the background?
You can certainly make the case, as you just did very eloquently. You know, there's a lot going on in his life. I'm sure there's a lot of contracts, numbers flying around. What do I do? What's the right thing to do? Yeah, you could be right. I mean, people act in strange ways when they're under stress. And I would be surprised if he's not feeling a bit of that right now, because, as you say, there's a lot going on. There's big, big decisions to be made.
Can I ask both of you just about the old heads that may eventually end up back on the European Tour? So we're obviously talking Westwood, Garcia, Poulter, Stenson, GMAC. Is there somebody else I'm leaving out there? Essentially, 5 years ago, we're all certified, guaranteed future Ryder Cup captains. The succession plan was in place for the best part of a decade, if not longer. Obviously, in their absence, we're going to have the first three-time captain since Bernard Gallagher with Luke Donald. Do you ever envisage a day, John, where any one or a number of those guys have their image rehabilitated in European Tour terms to the extent where they could potentially be a Ryder Cup captaincy candidate down the line?
Well, I'm not so sure about the captaincy. I can see the European Tour feeling generous enough to let them come back and play. I mean, they all contributed, the guys that you just mentioned, they all contributed hugely to the growth of the European Tour. And, I mean, things have been said, particularly Lee Westwood and Ian Poulter have said things publicly that the European Tour wouldn't have liked. And there's been a lot of to and fro between those two and the tour. But my mind still goes back, and I'm sure Gary will remember this too, that the Lee Westwood, is in particular, during COVID, I mean, he pitched up and played in a lot of events at a time when the European Tour needed names on his level. And I think it would be a nice gesture to draw a line under, as I say, some of the things that have gone between the two groups. And the Tour should make a gesture and let them play. I mean, I would like to see them play. I mean, they can still play a bit. I don't think any of them are going to win tournaments on the regular tour anymore. But golf's never just been about that. I mean, it's a business as well, and you want to get people through the door, you want to get bums on seats, and you want to create buzz. These guys have been, all of them that you mentioned, they've all been very good with me during my journalistic career. They've always talked, maybe Poulter maybe would be the only exception to that. He and I have gone back and forth a little bit, but I would argue for it. It would be a nice gesture for the tour to do that. Don't let them just walk straight back in. There's got to be some kind of, reparations done on their side as well. But I don't know how Gary would feel. I mean, what's the mood on tour? Gary would have a better feel for the mood on tour with that.
I think, John, their age profile is the problem. They're in their 50s. I think GMAC might have some chance, coming in as a vice captain in a dare next year if there was some kind of a softening, but. I agree with you. They've given a lot to the tour. You get dodgy invites every week. You know, there's Mickey Mouse categories as well, which they would all build. So it'd be nice to see them come back. But who knows? Who knows what's going to happen? Listen, there's loads of golf on this week. I hope you all enjoyed. John, thanks a million for coming on.
I'm sorry. I apologize again for my lateness.
Great to have you, John.
I'll try and stay awake next time. So,
Dave, thanks a million as always. Nathan's back with the Rhineline with Shane on Thursday. And thanks for listening, and we'll chat to you again next week.